Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for joining us once again as we continue to comb through this monster box of 5,000 plus baseball cards, primarily from the 1980s, going year by year, set by set. And today, we dive into one of my favorite sets. It's a limited set, but it's a good one. 1985 Fleer. And our random pull, Mr. Lloyd Mosby, number 115. Mosby, of course, a center fielder for the Toronto Blue Jays in the 1980s. Very underrated player, very underrated outfield and team in general. And I'll say this right out of the gate, while I normally do these podcasts as objective as possible, try to give you the most even-handed account of these cards and the players and their stories, I did grow up being a Toronto Blue Jays fan. I'll tell you the full story about that later, but since I was a Jays fan and 85 was a very good year for the Jays, I might be a little biased in some of my opinions here, but I'm sure we'll still be able to give you the best account of the 85 Fleer set and Lloyd Mosby and those Blue Jays teams of the 1980s. So we'll do that in just a little bit after we take a look at our questions and comments and thoughts from our fans who chime in on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. And you're always welcome to comment at Wax and Gum Stains. Doesn't necessarily have to be about a particular show or any comments that I say. If you just have any thoughts about baseball card collecting in general, or maybe some question that has perplexed you for years and you want to see if I have some assistance available for you in answering that question, again, at Wax and Gum Stains, that is the feed. We'll start off with a question from, or rather a comment from Rounded Corners, who was responding to our 1985 Donruss podcast from last week. And I mentioned in that podcast how the rated rookie subset, if you will, it wasn't really a subset, you know, it was part of the base set, but rated rookies, and I've panned the rated rookies from Donruss before in the sense that nine times out of ten, they weren't really great ball players by any stretch of the imagination. But 85 Donruss really kind of set the bar for a few lackluster rated rookies, as the rated rookies that year, basically your star players, as time would tell, were Danny Tartable and Sean Dunston. And I made a little crack saying that if Sean Dunston's your number two rated rookie, then you know that, the pool's a little shallow when it comes to rated rookie candidates. And I say that with all due respect to a guy like Sean Dunston. I mean, he had a far better big league career than you or I ever had. So, you know, whenever I crack on a player like that, it's out of jest. They've played more baseball games and have had more plentiful baseball careers than anybody listening to this podcast probably has. But again, when you're looking at about 20 cards and Danny Tartable and Sean Dunston are your top two, that means the others didn't quite live up to the billing. And of course, that was part of the situation with Doug Loman, who was a rated rookie, although even though he didn't make it big in baseball, he's now a man of God running a church out of Las Vegas. So Rounded Corners making the point that the Sean Dunston reminded him of how he learned how to spell Sean differently, because Sean Dunston, if you spell it out, it's actually Shawan, almost, S-H-A-W-O-N. And Rounded Corners notes that normally you'd spell Sean S-H-A-W-N. So, hey, you learn something new every day. We all learned how to spell Sean Dunston. And I was able to counter with, after we figured out Sean Dunston, if you watched enough Cubs games on WGN in the 80s, Doug DiCenzo was the next name that you learned how to spell. It was one of the first funny names that you not only learned how to spell, but DiCenzo, it just kind of rolls right off the tongue, doesn't it? So thank you very much, Rounded Corners, for chiming in on the spelling and grammar lessons that we had through 85 Donruss. Now, we also mentioned 85 Donruss, a very difficult set to find in pristine condition because of the black borders. Snug Collectibles chiming in saying about the 85 set, 85 was a nice design for Donruss, but the black border, dang. And then I mentioned that Donruss would unleash that beast once again in 1987. Remember those? 87 Donruss with the primarily black border. They had a little bit of a gray border in the center of the card. And we'll talk about 87 Donruss in a few weeks when we make our way through the box to there. But Snug Collectibles responding to that, oh my God, 87 Donruss, that was a good card design too. Still Love top 71 as far as black borders go. And you're right, 71 tops, and we mentioned this in the 85 Donruss set, even though it was very frustrating for collectors to find those absolute gem mint cards with the black borders, even if you found one that was in, I don't know, excellent, very good condition even, they were still a thing of beauty. 71 tops really set the bar with that. And you've had a lot of cards since then. We mentioned 85, 87 Donruss. I also remember 91 Score. They actually had, I think, four card color borders. They had kind of this teal, they had a dark blue, they had white, and then they had some cards that were black. And naturally, the black cards were the first, I think, 100 cards in Series 1. So those were the ones that got opened up first, they got handled the most, they got put into the boxes and binders quicker. So naturally, the borders started wearing down a lot easier, or a lot faster, I should say, than the blue and the bluish-green teal borders there. But even though others have tried to mimic the 71 top set, 71 tops just set the bar there, and it's a thing of beauty, because when you look at 71 tops, it's not only a work of art, but it also kind of just looks like 1971, and tops had a very good knack of doing that. No matter what the card design was, it represented that particular year very well. So thank you very much for chiming in on that, Snug Collectibles. One other comment from our listener, Samuel Watkins, just sent me a note saying, I binge listened to all of the episodes on an overseas flight. Please keep them coming. Well, thank you very much, Samuel. I'm glad I could be there to entertain you. Although we're on, episode 15? So these things are running typically about 25, 30 minutes. It's like 7 hours of listening to me. God bless you. I don't know. I don't know if that's dedication or a mild form of insanity, but I'm glad that I was here to entertain you. And being a car collector yourself, I'm sure you probably picked up a few things you didn't know, and you were probably reminded of a few things from perhaps your childhood or some older card sets that you were able to rummage through, much like I'm doing here with this monster box. So glad I could entertain you, and thank you very much for listening. And I also want to thank Beans Ball Card Blog, also Freedom Cardboard, for continuing to spread the word. People like Samuel who have binge listened. And for anybody who's listening to this podcast, keep it going, in the sense that I will continue to keep these shows coming out, preferably twice a week. We're aiming for every Tuesday and Friday with a new show. But as I've said in plenty of podcasts before, if you invite one friend to listen to the podcast, to follow us on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains, that will continue to grow our audience. And I'm not making a dime off this show. So basically, we're just trying to add some more people just to listen to it and really reminisce. You know, some of us still collect these days. I still do, although certainly not to the extent when I was a kid. So I still occasionally buy the old pack or buy a few packs of today's cards. But when you get a chance to go back to the cards that you collected in your childhood, it's really, really fun. I mean, you reminisce. It's not like you're going through some kind of mid-age crisis. You're just going through this, and all of a sudden the great memories of your elementary years or your teenage years come through these card collections, and that's just really cool. And I've mentioned this before in a podcast, but if you're new, I'll bring it up again. And correct me if I'm wrong, maybe I'm the only one who sees it this way, but, you know, nowadays, adults are trying to find new and exciting ways to calm down, if that makes any sense. It's new and exciting! Exhale. No. What I mean by that is, we're looking for ways to blow off steam. We're looking for ways to de-stress. And it's not that easy to do, especially with mobile phones, with technology. You're always connected. You're never away from the office. You're never away from the news. You're never away from, politicians screaming at each other, or, you know, crime reports getting out there. So-and-so was shot last night or run over by their wife this morning. It's just not that easy to get away from it. So adults are now, you know, buying coloring books and, you know, spending a lot of money on coloring books to kind of let the stress go. I get the therapeutic thing behind coloring books. I'd rather buy mine from the dollar store. You get the exact same effect, save a few bucks. But for me, you know, going through these old baseball cards and buying a pack every now and then, it's a stress reliever. There's just, for me, there's nothing more stress relieving than opening up a pack, looking to see who you got. You know, if it's a new pack of cards, looking at the new designs, getting to know today's players better, looking for the insert cards as well, or the subsets, you know, all those special additional cards that you get. And then if it's an older pack, well, that's even better because you get to go through the designs that you grew up with as a kid. You get to see some of the rookie cards, some of the star cards too from back in the day. So some people prefer coloring books. I prefer opening up baseball cards. And if you've made it through this podcast this far, or if you're like Samuel and you've listened to the previous 13 or 14 of them, then you find some kind of joy in that. And I'm glad that through this hobby, even though I don't collect the same way that I used to many, many, many years ago, you still find some joy in it. And anywhere you can find joy in the world today, within the limits of the law, I'm all for. Hey, there's certain ways you can find joy outside the law, but we call that vices, and that's for a different podcast. All right, as for today's podcast, 1985 Fleer Lloyd Mosby, number 115, our selection. Let me start with Lloyd Mosby because, again, I grew up as a Blue Jays fan, and I grew up being a Blue Jays fan here in Tampa, Florida, for absolutely no good reason. I'm still trying to figure out why I picked the Blue Jays as my team, because I didn't really know, this was in the late 80s, even though they were a good team, I didn't know how good of a team they were. I didn't know they were going to win a World Series, actually back-to-back World Series several years later. I always come down to this. It was probably a logo. Maybe I saw a jersey or a hat. That's typically what gets somebody around the age of 8, 9, 10 years old to like a team. You know, the team kind of looks good. You know, they look cool. So I started following the Blue Jays, and I was very fortunate there was a TV station here in Tampa that actually aired Blue Jay games, I think, on the weekends. So you would get the occasional game on ESPN because, again, the Blue Jays were starting to become a very good team at this time. But you would also get probably two, if you were lucky, they showed all three games, but, you know, at least two games of a weekend series were shown on a local TV station. So I was able to watch that team on a regular basis, got to know who the players were, got to kind of understand how they were building that team. And Lloyd Mosby was one of those guys who was still on the team when I started watching the Blue Jays in the late 80s. Of course, his time with them would end shortly thereafter. But he was really an underrated player and part of an underrated outfield. He was the center fielder. In left field was George Bell. In right field was Jesse Barfield. And these guys weren't exactly, you know, they didn't stick out like Daryl Strawberry or Barry Bonds or guys like that in the late 1980s, even though statistically they were pretty much right up there with most of them. But, you know, I think part of it, too, was because they were with Toronto. The Blue Jays were not a very good team up until the mid-80s. And then still, they were overshadowed by, you had the Mets, you had the Dodgers, you had, you know, the Cardinals were regularly in the World Series. You had, you know, Boston as well. You know, the Red Sox were contenders for a few years during that time span. So being in Toronto, Mosby and the Blue Jays kind of got the raw end of the deal there. They didn't quite get the coverage that they needed. But those of us who followed the Blue Jays and those of us who really followed baseball knew how special of a team that was and how dynamic of an outfield that was. Mosby was a very speedy player, had a little pop in his bat. He averaged 17 home runs a season, was a .257 career hitter. And as I mentioned, speedy, he averaged, I think it was 28 stolen bases a season. Now, that was the average. That number obviously started coming down the older that he got. But I still think that he hit 30, 35 most years in his career. So he was your stereotypical center fielder. And he actually started out as a first baseman. He converted to the outfield after he was drafted by the Blue Jays, second overall in the 1978 amateur draft. He went to Medicine Hat, the Blue Jays' longtime rookie league club. I think their first 25 years of existence, the Blue Jays had that team in Medicine Hat, Alberta. They moved him to the outfield, and that was a career-changing, in a good way, a change for Lloyd Mosby. So you had Mosby, the the prototypical speedy center fielder with a little pop in his bat. In left field, just the absolute cannon of George Bell in terms of the bat. I mean, he was a pretty good outfielder as well. But here's a guy, people forget, this guy was a really dominant outfielder, a little moody. He certainly wore out his welcome in Toronto, especially after a contract squabble in the late 80s. But you had George Bell in left field, patrolling right field Jesse Barfield, who also had quite a bit of pop in his bat. But also, Barfield was a Gold Glove winning outfielder, had an absolute cannon of an arm. He could gun down guys at home plate from 270 feet away in right field down the line. And he'd hit them on a line with one solid throw. You know, not one of those 18 hoppers that manages to get to the catcher while a very slow running base runner makes his way around third. So a very underrated outfield. And Mosby was just one of those guys who had a very good attitude, seemed to be a pretty upbeat guy, and was part of that Blue Jay team, even though he didn't win a World Series with them in 92 or 93. He was part of that core that helped elevate the Blue Jays from an absolute laughingstock into a very classy organization. The Blue Jays were contenders from basically 1984 through 93. That's a 10-year stretch where they contended for the World Series, as I mentioned, won a couple of World Series, and he was one of the many pieces that helped make that transition from doormat in the American League East to world champions eventually in the early 1990s. Now, Mosby's time with the Blue Jays, he got called up in 1980, a very early call-up. Again, the Blue Jays going with the youth movement as they had just started, and they started stockpiling some talent. So he was one of those guys who was there, not only with Barfield and Bell in the early days, but you look at guys like Dave Steeb and Ernie Witt. Jimmy Key would come along in the mid-80s. And I'm trying to think who else was in there. Tony Fernandez was another one. Alfredo Griffin has spent a little time in Toronto, and he would actually come back in those World Series days in the early 90s. So this was part of a core group that helped elevate the team from just an absolute joke of a team into a consistent contending team. Now, he would play with the Blue Jays through 1989, left as a free agent. I'm assuming the Blue Jays thought that either Junior Felix or Glenn Allen Hill could kind of take the reins in center field and run with it. They didn't. In fact, the Blue Jays in 1990, the first year without Mosby in center, had, I think, four or five guys playing center field. It was a platoon system. Clearly was a weakness because the Jays would go out and get Devon White from California in 1991. And Devo, as they'd call him, would be a mainstay in center field during those World Series years for a few years. So Mosby moves on as an unrestricted free agent. He goes to Detroit for a couple years, starts slipping just a little bit. He's still productive, but of course he's not the Lloyd Mosby who was 23, 24 years old in his early days with the Blue Jays. The Tigers, of course, also in a transition time then. A team that had won the World Series in 84, stunned the Blue Jays to win the AL East in 87, took a couple steps back in the late 80s. They would become contenders, although they wouldn't win the division. They gave the Blue Jays a bit of a chase in 91 and 92, if I recall, as did Milwaukee around that time too. But he was just part of a team that was in transition, so he kind of really falls off the radar here, because even though the Tigers are in Detroit and everyone loves the Detroit Tigers, they weren't doing so well. So his career numbers dip a little bit. His, you know, he was already off the radar in Toronto, so now he's really off the radar in a bad team at Detroit. And then he went over to Japan to play for a couple of seasons, and his professional baseball career ended after 1993. Now, Mosby was a first base coach for the Blue Jays in the late 1990s, and since then has become, for lack of a better term, an ambassador. Not that ambassador is a bad term, but I don't know his official job title, but basically becoming an ambassador for baseball in Canada. And actually recently, this was a couple years ago, visiting Medicine Hat, the place where his professional baseball career started, as he was part of a youth camp initiative, not just in Medicine Hat, but throughout Canada. A lot of former Blue Jays were part of this caravan, and he was able to go out and teach the finer points of being an outfielder and a pretty darn good hitter, too, to the youth throughout rural Canada. So it's good to see that even though he's not involved in the game in terms of, you know, being a minor league manager or you know, a coach somewhere else, he was able to be part of this kind of coaching caravan for kids throughout Canada. And it's kind of neat to see a guy find his roots again in a tiny little town like Medicine Hat, Alberta. So there you go, Lloyd Mosby, our random pull, card number 115 from the 85 Fleer set. And 85 Fleer is one of my favorites. It is just another beautiful, well-executed card set by Fleer. This would be their third consecutive year where they just absolutely nailed it. Now, if 1983 Fleer was business and 1984 Fleer was business with a suit and tie, in my opinion, 1985 Fleer is business, but with a sensible cardigan sweater. You know, there's a little bit of a yuppie-ish look to this 1985 Fleer set. It still works, though. It's still an absolutely beautiful card. But let's take a look at the front of this Lloyd Mosby card, as we've got Lloyd striking a rather vicious pose in a batting cage before a game, wearing the alternate Blue Jay top and the powder blue pants. And by the way, I love that powder blue. It's come back. You know, it looked ridiculous in the 80s, but you know, now it's come back with a vengeance. Although I never really liked when the Blue Jays wore the powder blues as alternates at home. You know, those are road jerseys. Come on. This isn't the NBA. You know, there's a home jersey and there's a road jersey. Well, now they've abandoned the powder blue. They've gone back to the early 90s look, if you will, with a few tweaks. But Lloyd's wearing his 84 Blue Jays outfit here. And you look at that Fleer card. You've got a nice clear shot of Mosby. The photography, again, in 1985 was very good. About 90% of the front of the card is dedicated to that great photography. The gray border around it, you also have the team logo on it and the player name and position as well. And of course, as I've said before, I'm a big fan of putting a baseball team's logo anywhere. So anytime you can prominently feature that on the front of a card, I am all for it. You flip the card over on the back. What worked in 83 and 84 for Fleer would work again in 85. As you have at the top, you have all the personal information, player's name, position, and then you've got the whole litany of stats beneath it. You've got the vertical striping there, this time going with red and white, where in previous years they went with brown and white or blue and white, so red and white here. You also have the little mini picture in the upper right-hand corner. This would be the last year that Fleer would use this. In fact, in 1985, they were the only card set to feature two pictures. They and Topps had a picture on the front and a picture on the back in 83 and 84. Well, Fleer was the only one to do it in 85, and this would be the last year they did it. They abandoned that in 86. It was kind of neat, you know, having the little picture on there and being able to promote, hey, we've got two pictures on our card, one on the front, one on the back. But I do have to say, you know, the shtick started running out here. You know, it was a neat little gimmick, but by 85 it had run its course. And the fact that the back photo was maybe half an inch by half an inch and it was black and white, sometimes it would appear a little grainy or a little blurry. And you kind of lose the effect of bragging about having a second picture on the back when the second picture wasn't really all that great. And they were still sometimes, not always, but sometimes using the front picture on the card on the back. They would just crop it and cram it into the corner there, and that kind of defeats the purpose of bragging about having two pictures on one card. But still, the 85 Fleer back, even though, like I said, the back photo was a gimmick that had run its course by then, still looks very sharp. And I think that's a great word to describe the 85 Fleer set. Is it still business? Yes. Is it dressed down business? Is it casual Friday in 1985 business? Yeah. But it still looks very sharp. And if we can compare 85 Donruss to the 71 top set, I don't think it's that far of a stretch to say the 85 Fleer is like 70 tops with the gray borders. It looks very clean and crisp and classy, and it is just a great set to get your hands on. Now, much like 85 Donruss, and to that extent, 71 tops and 70 tops, the gray borders do present a little bit of a problem in terms of upkeep. That is, you would have the occasional flecking of the edges. You would have, the color would rub off sometimes depending on how the cards were handled. So much like 85 Donruss, it's not that easy to find gem, mint, or pristine 85 Fleer sets or individual cards. So there's a little bit of a manhunt to make that happen. Now, also, 85 Fleer, while Fleer never officially announced how many sets they produced or how many packs or singles or whatever, you know, they never put out an official card count, it is believed that 85 Fleer was produced in smaller numbers compared to the counterparts at Donruss and Topps that year. And while there was no official word about that, I would say that's not a stretch of the imagination, because 85 Fleer, very difficult to find even nowadays. Of course, some of the premium cards in it are one of the reasons why it's a little hard to find packs and complete sets in great quantities like some other sets from around that time. So I would say that there's a very good chance that there was some, I wouldn't say limited production, but certainly less than what the competition was putting out there. So my personal 85 Fleer set, much like 84 and 83 Fleer, which were hard to find for lack of production, and also because by the time I started collecting, some of the bigger stars or some of the bigger rookie cards had become bigger stars by then. My personal collection, very limited. I only had like 30 or 40 cards from that year, and I don't think I ever bought a single pack of 85 Fleer, even though that was my preferred method of collecting cards. I just ended up collecting a bunch of cards from the 85 Fleer set through other various means. But even though it's limited in my personal collection, I love these cards. These are, again, very sharp cards and very representative of the yuppie side of 1985. And if you're old enough to remember 1985 and the yuppie class that was starting to come through then, I think you see where I'm coming at here. And that's not to say that this is a bad card. It's a beautiful card, beautiful set, and Fleer really putting together another awesome set. And as I mentioned in our 83 Fleer podcast a few weeks back, you know, 83 kind of set the tone for the 80s for Fleer, and you would see just countless quality sets being made by Fleer all throughout the 1980s, and this one is no exception. And Fleer would continue that in particular 86 and 87, and even though 88 and 89 were not as refined as the early 80s sets, this was just one of many in a long line of really good sets that Fleer put out. And that's saying something, considering the first two sets from Fleer were, let's just say, lacking in some quality, although certainly not quantity. It was a lot easier to find those cards. The big cards from the 85 Fleer set include Roger Clemens and Kirby Puckett, technically their first rookie cards, even though Fleer was able to scoop Topps and Donruss in 1984 with Kirby Puckett and Roger Clemens showing up in their update set. But if you're a believer that rookie cards are only found in the base sets and not those bonus sets released later in the year, then, well, these are your rookie cards. So the Puckett Clemens cards really drive the 85 Fleer set. Also, you've got the second year card of Don Mattingly. You've got a rookie card for Dwight Gooden, Oral Hershiser, Eric Davis as well. So much like a lot of the other sets in this time period, you've got some quality rookies. You've got some young stars who appeared in the major leagues or debuted in the major leagues earlier in the decade. Those cards carry some weight. And also the veteran cards too, you know, players who made their major league debuts in the mid-70s, perhaps even earlier. You know, guys like Nolan Ryan, Mike Schmidt, Pete Rose, you still got not only value, but some really good cards for players like that through the years. So 85 Fleer, another outstanding card set. I wouldn't say underrated, just hard to find now, but if you could still get your hands on them, be it a few wax packs or even a lot, you know, you can find like a vending box lot or something like that, go ahead and get them. This is a very fun set to have, and a very sharp set, and one that, you know, most of your cards may end up in a cardboard box like mine have, you know, this big old monster box. But there's something very classy about 85 Fleer, a little gray pouponish, where you want to just put the cards, even the common ones that are worth a nickel, you want to put them in plastic pages because they just look so good. All right, so what are your thoughts about 85 Fleer? What are your thoughts about Lloyd Mosby, card collecting in general? Let me know at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. Also, I want your thoughts about 85 tops. That's our next set. We'll take a look at that on Friday. And I'll just lead with this. 85 tops. I like it. But the more I look at it, I go, wow, it's a little discombobulated. It's a good set. But there's just something that's holding me back from saying it's a great set, like I'm able to do with Fleer and Donruss. So we'll talk about that. We'll do a random pull as well. So join us next time for Wax Ecstatic. Comment away on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for tuning into the latest Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.